You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be running her do.
Come over here, kid. Why, son? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic.
It's
and you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick.
And
you gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. And a little bit of wine. And a little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious. Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. If you had a great weekend, yesterday was May Day. Maybe you were even dancing around a maypole somewhere. There were a few in town. I hope you made it to a farmer's market. I made it to two this weekend. We've got a packed show tonight. We're going to be talking with some tribal elders from both the Kashaya Pomo and the Manchester Point Arena Pomo about the recent... What sounds like to me severe restrictions on what can be gathered from the coast and where. And I've also got a ticket giveaway for you at the end of the show. But before that, we're going to talk to somebody who's almost a regular here on Mouthful. It's John Stewart of both Bovalo and Zazu and Black Pig Bacon. Should see his pig tattoos. He's going to be John's going to be talking about an event coming up on Saturday, Farm to Feast. I was there one year. Really, really a fun event. Hi, John.
How's it going?
It's okay. Welcome to Mouthful. You did your grow your own BLT today?
Yes, we did. We were out with some friends out in Sebastopol, and they do plant starts, so they were getting tomatoes ready, and we were out there selling pulled pork sandwiches and vegetarian chili.
Did you bring me one?
I did not.
Darn. Oh, well. Next
you know,
time.
Life gets in the way. I had all these grandiose plans of like platters of, I was making rabbit pâtés this morning and, you know,
yeah,
but there's none here, so I don't want to tease you. That's
okay.
Not fair.
So tease us about the event that's coming up. First of all, it's a benefit for Summerfield Waldorf.
Yes, the Summerfield Waldorf School, mm-hmm. Where my children attend. And we are doing the dinner that we call Farm to Feast. You can check out all the information at farmtofeast.org. And, I'll be cooking the dinner along with my wife, Dusky Estes, Tracy Desjardins from Jardinaire and Public House and any number of restaurants in San Francisco. Nick Payton, who is the owner and maitre d' up at Cyrus in Healdsburg. His kids also attend the school. So we'll be doing all of that along with any number of delicious local wineries.
Now, is Nick actually going to be there?
Nick is going to be there. Nick will be, you know, doing his job in the front of the house.
Uh-huh.
You know, sort of running the show.
Yeah.
So that we have the pleasure of, it's actually a very fun event for us because we are all professionals, but we are also parents at the school. So having Nick in the front and us in the back, it's, you know, many times these school fundraisers are kind of a nightmare for a lot of people, but we sort of do this every day. So
yeah.
When they're like, you're cooking for 100 people, and it's like, it's not a big deal for us.
No, not a big deal.
It's like me, yeah.
And plus, Nick, if you've never been to Cyrus, and, you know, Cyrus is not an inexpensive restaurant, and I think people who haven't been think that it might be a somewhat more subdued experience than it ends up when Nick is the maitre d'. I have rarely laughed as hard as I laughed the night I had dinner there with my daughter. He was just, he's really elegant. He does fabulous service, but he's also drop dead funny.
Yes, yes. And we are all, you know, we are lucky out here to have Nick, to have people like that, where we take so much of what we do so incredibly serious, and then other things we don't take.
Yeah, and then you have fun on top of it.
Yes.
So where's the where's the event taking place?
The event is going to take place at the school.
Oh, it's at the school
yes.
this year.
So in the right next to the farm, where they keep all the other animals.
And that's off of Willowside Road.
Off of Willowside Road in Western Santa Rosa, very close to Zazu, our restaurant. And yeah, so it'll happen there underneath this beautiful walnut tree. They hang lights from it, and we set up tables. And
about how many people do you expect or hope for?
We are expecting 150.
150.
So that's, you know, what we're looking for. There are tickets available, and you can get them at the website that I mentioned. And yeah, it should be a lot of fun.
And tell me about the special guest.
The special guest is Randall Graham, so from Bonnie Doon.
Speaking of drop dead funny.
Yeah, exactly. And again, like a sort of total pioneer in inorganic and then biodynamic. And a lot of the focus of the meal this year is around biodynamic farming. Rudolf Steiner, obviously, the creator of the Waldorf curriculum, it also created a large part of, you know, created biodynamic farming. So that is something that we are very much focusing on. And, yeah, bringing Randall Graham in from Bonnie Doon is, you know, it's pretty special. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and he has a book out, and I think he'll have copies of the book there. Been Doon so long, and I've been reading it. It's, I mean, he's brilliant.
Yes, and again, really like that sort of, like, very sort of, you know, tradition-based but completely irreverent, you know, sort of you see it in the posters and, you know, taking funny very seriously.
Yeah, taking, and also he has a real passion for, what should we call it, really authentic wines, wines that are really close to the earth.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, and he's all, he sees himself as someone who's really bucked the marketing trends and sort of pandering to a market that doesn't necessarily understand what he's trying to do. He's I think he's really articulate about that.
Yes, yes. No, and I mean, you know, it's the interesting ones that make really good things, you know? Boring people make boring stuff. I almost don't care what you do.
I agree. in any area. do you know what you're going to be cooking yet?
Yes, we do. Obviously, I make cured meats, all sorts of good things, so we will be starting with various cured meats, some pâtés and things like that from the Felton Farms, which is a pig that we got this past week from them. There's a pizza oven on the campus that the students actually built, so we'll be doing pizzas out of that. Deviled eggs from chickens at the farm, as well as radishes with some goat butter and probably salt.
Goat butter and radishes. That's I love goat butter, and you don't see it very often.
No, my wife is nuts about it.
I absolutely love it. I was finding it. Oh, who was it? Somebody local was making it, and then they quit.
Yes, and Cyrus has it as well as part of their sort of like butter accoutrement. You know,
and nice thin sliced breast, any kind of good radish with butters. So
yes, and they're a lot of the things that are available to us at the moment. We are very much focusing on what is available at the farm, at the school.
So you've got leeks from the school?
Leeks from the school will be the first course, and Tracy Desjardins will be handling all of that. A farro salad with lettuce. The lettuces are from the school. The farro is from Italy, but we love farro. There is some that's more available locally at Canvas Ranch.
Right, but, but it's sold out.
It is sold out, but it's cool that they're doing it.
Yeah.
You know, many people who are sort of gluten intolerant can eat farro because it predates all the sort of hybridization of wheat. Then we're going to be doing a cassoulet with Jim Riker, Liberty Farms duck, more sausage from this pig from Felton Farms, and it'll be more of a springtime. There'll be probably asparagus, fava beans, fava leaves, a lighter, not that traditional duck, not that traditional cassoulet.
What kind of beans are you going to use?
Probably fava beans, peas.
Oh, fava. Oh, okay.
Yes.
Oh, so really light.
Really light. Yes, yes, yes. You know, we're looking to have people spend money when they're done with this whole meal. So, you know, it's all leading up to that. And then the desserts are going to be done by another parent at the school who has Galaxy Desserts, which is down in Richmond, I believe.
Yeah, and then there's going to be, there's always a both silent and live auction, right?
Correct. Yes, and there's all sorts of really cool silent auction as well as live auction packages.
There's something, I think it was on the Facebook page for Claypool Cellars.
Yes, Wes Claypool.
They're doing a pretty wild tour. You buy it this year and it takes place next year.
Yes, and there's
a two-day, rather indulgent thing on a luxury bus.
Yeah, I did a sausage-making thing with Bruce Adels one time.
And I wasn't the year I was there. Peter Krause was auctioning off acting lessons, which I thought would be really cool.
You know, so again, that it's a very unique school. It's a very different place, and there's people who are very successful in in somewhat alternative ways. They're not sort of straight and narrow. It's not mm-hmm. the suit and tie, 9 to 5. And,
yeah.
you know, those people are there. But, mm-hmm. you know, the school is a very unique gathering of people. And as a community, we're trying to include as many people as possible. 35% of the students at the school receive a scholarship of some sort to assist them in being there.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, the school raised $750,000 to assist people and, you know, trying to make the school as much as possible represent the community that we're in,
mm-hmm.
you know, and be a part of that and bring that whole community together.
Yeah, that's great. One thing I think when people hear about something like this, and they don't know the school, they've never had a connection to it, sometimes I think people are a little hesitant to think about attending an event because it's like, will I feel like an outsider? Will I not know anybody? Will I be uncomfortable? So do you draw from the community at large for these events? And, you know, is there a host who makes everyone feel comfortable? You know what I mean?
That's yes, you know, you always want to draw from the community as, uh-huh. as much as possible. The host is... just a school board member, mm-hmm. but you know the school is a very open and welcoming place.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's not so much even thinking that it wouldn't be. It's just I'm thinking more of the shyness of people who aren't familiar with a place and seeing if we can get some over that hurdle.
Well, they need to just kind of go. I mean, it's an awesome mm-hmm. meal. It's you know we are very lucky to have a group of parents who are also such a sort of culinary powerhouse
yeah.
and. Any number of local wines. I mean, the same people that would attend any one of a local winery mm-hmm. type event or a dinner at a restaurant should be intrigued to go yeah. to this for the simple fact that it's, you know, it's going to be awesome. And it's a convergence of so many things. There are so many parents at the school who have wineries, you know, the Martinelli family, the Davises up in Healdsburg, mm-hmm. Literai, you know, Preston, uh-huh. Chiavera. And then again, you know, all the chef talent that's there with Nick running the front. And
so really it's just Sonoma County and
it's
Sonoma
totally
County expressing
Sonoma County
itself
exactly.
at this particular location.
And it just happens to be yeah. at this one school yeah. where it all came together.
I mean, and it's beautiful grounds. How big is the garden? Like 22, 23 acres?
It's 28 acres.
28, yeah.
You know, and
the kids are involved. It's part of the curriculum.
The kids are totally involved in it. They farm at some point every single week. There are chickens and rabbits and horses mm-hmm. and sheep and, you know, it is as much biodynamic as it can be. And, you know, it's a really special place. I'm very proud to have my kids there.
And it's taking place next Saturday. That's May 8th.
Correct.
What time does it start?
That is a good question, and I might not have that answer.
Okay, but you can find out if you
I
go to
totally
farmtofeast.org. You'll find out it's $150
starts
per person.
Starts at 5.
Starts at 5. Sorry. $150 a person.
Correct.
The money goes into the scholarship fund for financial aid.
Yes, and you can get all of that at farmtofeast.org.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm going to let you go home to your kids.
Excellent.
I know they'd
like to see me.
They'd like to see you a little bit.
There you go. Yes.
Okay, and we're going to take a little musical break in just a second and be back with our next set of guests. But in the meantime, I want to tell you to check your calendar. I have a pair of tickets that I'm going to give away to a hula performance. It is happening on May 15th from 1 to 3 p.m. down at the really beautiful Hamilton Amphitheater Park. It's a great place to see hula outdoors and really lovely. There's going to be a lot of, your girls might like this, there's going to be 9 little girls dancing with all the 50 hula sisters, and I'll be there in some of the dances.
That's
as
funny.
Well.
Mackenzie's teacher at school is from Hawaii, and they have hula things.
Oh, cool. So, yeah, kids.
Or
kids
she at least attempts to get yeah. everybody to hula.
Well, kids
it's
10 and under are free. The tickets for adults are $10. And at the end of the show, right when I'm telling you goodnight, I will. I'll decide before then what color I'll take, but I'll be giving away a pair of tickets. But before I do that, I want you to check your calendar and make sure you can go because we really want people there. So we're going to take a musical break and be right back here on Mouthful.
Hey ho, oh, hem, no, K-K-A-Ku, K-K-I-M-U. Make ala o kalipoa. He ho o henno, ke ike aku, ke kai moana nui la, nui ke aloha e hii porine. Make ala o kalipoa.
Kuvuga ibituwamo no kalahu
It's Mouthful. It's Michelle Jordan. Thanks for tuning in. You may have read either online or in the lovely print edition of the Press Democrat. Newspapers feel so good to hold in your hand. About new regulations, new marine preserves, new restrictions on what can be gathered from the coast and where. I first became aware of this because Violet Wilder, a member, is that the right way to say it? Member of the Kashaya Pomo, is a Hula sister. And so I have to thank you very much, Violet, for arranging for these guests to be here in the studio. We have Eric Wilder, former chairman of the Kashaya Pomo. Is that the right way to say it?
Yes.
Okay. We also have Otis Parrish, tribal elder, historian, author, all sorts of things.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much for being here. And then from the Manchester Point Arena band of Pomo Indians, we have Nelson Pinola.
Thank you.
So one of the things I want to do throughout the hour is really understand as much as we can in a short time about your tribe and its history and its traditions. But I think we should probably start first by talking about what has just happened, where these new restrictions came from and what it means for you.
Essentially, what it is the California passed the Marine Life Preservation Act, and this was passed in 99, which directed the state to do a complete comprehensive coordination of their marine preservation protected areas along the coast of California. The tribes became involved during their second round, which was the actual North Coast Project, which began in, I believe it was 2007. And I became one of the stakeholders that was on the group of about 40 or so that were selected and vetted by the state and appointed to help in that process. Mm-hmm. So that was the very first time that tribes were involved at all. And my alternate to that was Nick Tippon, who was with the Federated Great Indians here in Sonoma County. And throughout the course of that, there were many meetings, and ultimately ended up, after a two-year process, there ended up being a selection made by the state in California what those protected areas and reserves were going to be. And that was finally implemented on Saturday. Mm-hmm. And there was a delay from January. I'm not certain as to why, but I did receive email notification that it would be delayed until May, and thus that's the reason that we're here today.
Mm-hmm. So what is it specifically that's restricted?
Well, restriction, I believe, I haven't been involved with that mm-hmm. too long, so I think it's picking on or harvesting things like seaweed, abalone, mussels, other shellfish.
Uh-huh. So it's basically a restriction on all harvesting?
Pretty much. Yeah, even fishing.
Even fishing,
yes.
Okay, and it stretches from where to where?
I'm not sure.
Currently, the one that we're concerned about is actually the North Coast, which goes from Pigeon Point down San Mateo County all the uh-huh. way to Alder Creek, which is up in Mendocino County. Uh-huh. And for the tribes in particular and specifically, it is really going to have a negative impact on consumptive, non-consumptive uses. And the consumptive being, again, those uses as, Otis was just mentioning, food, things that the tribes have had for eons in their cultural ceremonies and mm-hmm. spring events and all those sorts of things. The non-consumptive uses, again, are those that were not mentioned or even considered, and that has to do with our religion.
Mm-hmm.
So the native tribes along California have our religion, which is not really recognized by the mainstream. So there's no consideration at all for the tribes or any exemptions or anything for the native people in California. And it's the one that I believe is actually a violation of the Constitution right now, because it actually violates our constitutional rights toward religious freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have our religion that that the ocean and the natural part of that plays a significant part of our lives. And that was not considered at all. But again, we're talking about consumptive, non-consumptive uses.
Can you talk about those non-consumptive uses? And I think maybe there's some things for show and tell, perhaps. I'd love to know more about that. I think it sounds really interesting.
What we have is what we call ceremonial piece, ceremonial object, which is sacred in our tradition. And that is the headband. It's a headband. It's a ceremonial headband used by dancers in ceremonies. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, we can't get these birds anymore. Uh-huh. You know, it's almost impossible because it's what's called it's rare.
Okay, so it's feathers from what bird?
It's from the what we call what is it?
Flicker, yellowhammer.
Flicker. The flicker bird. We have to order these from different areas of the state. Uh-huh. And we don't have any. We do have any, but we don't hunt them. Mm-hmm. Because of that.
Mm-hmm. And then what are some of the other things that are involved in the, would you say religious ceremonies, religious practices?
Yeah, that's a religious piece there. Okay. And this one is too. It's a, what we call it, a clamshell bead cross. Uh-huh. You see, and I've heard people say, well, you know, that comes from Christianity. Well, the symbol, the cross symbol, has been here for thousands
way
of years.
Way longer than Christianity. Way longer than Christianity, definitely.
Than Christianity.
Yeah.
When you think about our tribes, we think about thousands of years. I know the archaeology of our area, Nelson's and ours, have stated that we've been here at least in 13,500 years in testing some of the objects that
here on the North Coast.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. So, you know, it's been a part of our lives.
Yeah.
You know, part of our lives, our ancient people's lives, mm-hmm. and their ancient people's lives. Yeah. So it's to us that we can't get, like, the shells. We can't get the shells anymore.
And they're from, what, clam? And it looked like abalone clam, as well?
Yeah.
It looked like maybe the cross was abalone?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And, like, we had a clam bed up in Anchor Bay, California.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Russians found out about it, and there was no more. I mean, they took everything.
They took everything. Yeah, Has it come back at all?
No.
No, it hasn't come back.
It hasn't come back. Probably never will come back unless it's planted, but I don't see that happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like seaweed.
Mm-hmm.
Seaweed is important to us in our ceremonies.
Tell me about that. What do you have? I don't know if you brought, did you bring any seaweeds to see? No, I gathered seaweed once up out of Anchor Bay. I went with a woman. Do you know Donna Bishop? I think it's Donna Bishop. She manages the farmer's market at the Gualala Farmer's Market, and she also has a farm, but she's also licensed to gather seaweed. And so one of the things she sells at the farmer's market is seaweed. And I went with her, I think it was summer solstice in 2008 or 2009, and we got up at 5:30 in the morning and drove up and walked down. And she's fearless. I'm not fearless, but I went out pretty far, and we found many more types of seaweed than I even knew existed. It was very interesting, and took it home and dried it on my clothesline, that sort of thing. Still have some for making broth. So let me see what you brought.
What we do is we gather it, but we pull it off the rock and we dry it in little patties in the sun. We fry it like that very quickly because it burns really easily.
Is this wakame?
I'm not sure what the species is.
This is
sorry, I didn't get that for you.
I don't know.
So you fry it in little patties and then you fry it?
We dry it in the sun. It takes about a day to dry both sides, then we fry it in oil like that really quickly. It's crispy, and we eat that with tortillas. We roll it in a tortilla and eat it like that.
Interesting. Can I?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. I even have a tortilla if you want.
Oh, I'll try it. I've never had it like that, but that sounds really interesting. Okay, we put a little bit in there. Mm-hmm. We're going to hear the crunch.
And roll it up.
Roll it up.
There you go.
You know, I would never have thought to put those two things together, and this is really, really good. Now, does this mean you no longer have access to this?
Right.
That's
right.
Correct.
Right. We cannot gather anything, any seaweed, zero. We can't.
There are a variety of marine life that were very important. We can go from the seaweed. We had abalone, which are pretty common, and the mussels, mm-hmm. clams, and periwinkles also. Uh-huh. Also, we also ate a sea anemone. We had sea urchin.
You ate sea anemone?
Yes, sea urchin. And the sea urchin was really prized by the older folks, and mm-hmm. they would just... I remember going as a young child to the beach with my grandfather. He would crack open the sea urchins, mm-hmm. and he would eat out the sea urchin, and mm-hmm. he swears they tasted like fresh peaches. So, but this
wow.
is where the majority of the folks got their food. And again, we also had things like kelp, mm-hmm. Palm kelp, and for us, it was a treat as a kid. Because we would go to the beach and we would gather these foods. And these foods were prepared for storage for winter. We would gather them in mm-hmm. The summer months and stuff. And the fish were dried, the surfish, the small fish. Our salmon were dried and they were roasted and all sorts of things, smoked. And the kelp was really a treat for me because the kelp would be dried and would leave these traces of small salt upon it. So as kids, we'd be out tromping around the hills all day and stuff, and we'd have our little kelp in our back pocket. Mm-hmm. That was kind of like our nutrition that we kind of made do with. I guess it was that point was the Indian version of licorice for us.
Oh, okay. Or like sunflower seeds, that nice salty
yes,
thing. That's what I always
exactly.
carried with me when I was a kid with sunflower
yeah,
seeds.
Exactly.
And so have those foods, those traditional foods, remained a part of your diet all along? And so it's a really abrupt change now
yes,
with this new regulation.
Yes. My experience has been, it's really loved by our older folks, especially because if they get sick in the hospital, that's mm-hmm. what they want. You
sure,
know?
Of course.
Acorn mush and stuff from the ocean, and they want us to bring them that, you mm-hmm. know? So that's what really pained me when all this happened, is because mm-hmm. that brought that to mind. It's like, what are we going to do now? Because they won't have that. We can't bring that to them if they even get sick or something,
Do you have any avenue of recourse to change this?
Well, I think what we're looking at right now is myself and other tribal leaders that are sitting here are gathering with other tribes throughout California. And we're looking at several avenues that are available mm-hmm. to us at this point. And part of that is that we are used to working with federal government and some state agencies in a collaborative effort. Part of that is due in part to mandatory consultations between the federal government and the tribes here in California and the state of California. Mm-hmm. That did not really occur in this process. What happened was the law was passed and it was foisted upon us and they said, this is what the law is. And we protested, but to no avail because the law had already passed.
Uh-huh.
We did seek out several lawmakers and other interested parties. And those folks said, had we been aware what this negative impact was going to be to our native people, we would not have done this. We would have, at least had other consultation where we could have arrived at a method which would have been much more fairer to our native mm-hmm. people. And, of course, that's what we're looking for.
So maybe it can be amended in some way?
Yeah, I believe that's what we're going to have to do because uh-huh. it's the law. So, and there are no exemptions for native people within it. But, of course, there are state laws that are on the books and part of the Constitution where we have in conflict this current law with the mm-hmm. Marine Life Preservation Act and other laws in the state of California that call for a minimization of those laws and a look at the impacts when two laws are in conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the case here. So we will certainly be pursuing those avenues both with the state of California and the Bureau of Indian Affairs and uh-huh. Department of Interior, and they are actively involved in those efforts as we talk also.
Okay. We're going to take another little musical break, and we're going to come back, and let's talk about the history and, really current status of the tribes. Thank you.
O Kalapana
listening to Mouthful here on KRCB. We are talking with several people. Eric Wilder, former chairman of Kashaya Pomo, and my hula sister, Violet Wilder. You guys have the same last name. What's the relationship?
Violet's my older sister.
Oh, okay. We also have with us Otis Parrish, tribal elder, historian, and author, and many things. You're very well represented on the internet. And we also have Nelson Pinola, the chairman of the Manchester Point Arena Pomo. And I don't know if for this next part I have the right questions at hand, so I'm asking for your help. But how do we understand your tribes? You mentioned, Eric, 13,000, more than 13,000
yes.
years.
Yes.
And does that apply to all of the coastal Pomos?
I would say yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And then when did the tribe, I mean, your Kashaya and your Manchester Point Arena, what's the history of those distinctions?
Well, we go back to a place called the World Before. The World Before is where all the plants, animals, resided with Indian people. Mm-hmm. And in that place, we had one language. And so when the creator decided, well, you know, you have to leave. You've got to leave now. It's time for you to leave as human beings and animals and plants and whatever. And so when we came onto this land, we weren't able to communicate with the others, our families, what we call our families. Uh-huh. And so what happened then was that the creator said, well, we're only going to, you're only going to have one type of person who's going to be able to communicate for you, and those were the spiritual leaders, the spiritual people, the doctors. Mm-hmm. And so that's how it went. And then finally, you know, we were on the land, and we were there for a number of thousand years. Yeah. And so that's where we come from. That's how mm-hmm. we are here. Yeah. Our history goes back. You know, people say, well, you know, those are stories. Well, they're not stories. They're historical accounts. Mm-hmm. We consider them historical accounts. Some people call them myths. They're not myths. You know, they're historical accounts. So that's how I see, or that's how we were taught mm-hmm. as young people about our history. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of things about that history all depended on the time. Mm-hmm. Time and oral histories, mm-hmm. oral passing of the histories by oral. And so when we talk about our history, we're talking about our lives, our ancient people, mm-hmm. How they lived, how they sent down to us, how we should respect everything. You know, there's a thing in our both of our tribes that called the law of reciprocity. And the law of reciprocity, love reciprocity says that anytime you go and harvest from the wild, whatever you're harvesting, you have to have a way of contacting that entity. And the way you do it is through songs and prayers, and then ask for forgiveness for taking that food. Mm-hmm. So, and then in return, what you're doing is making sure that that food comes back just as great as last year. Mm-hmm. So that's a part of our history. Mm-hmm. That's why it's religious, you know, because mm-hmm. we have these laws of management, you know, laws of taboo. We had management systems long, 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 long before. Mm-hmm. You know? They've had it in Europe. They've had it here. And that's how we see things.
So never take too much.
No, yeah.
Always allow what's feeding you to thrive on its own.
Yeah, exactly. So that's, you know, even today we do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why we have what we have.
Yeah.
You know,
it's really interesting. It's really, when you compare what you're telling me to, say, what the Russians did, or if you also go back into some of the history of, say, Manhattan Island and the way they've completely, I mean, it used to be the most abundant oyster beds, mm-hmm. huge, huge oyster beds, and they are gone. Species of oysters that we'll never see in the world again. And it's like, I often wonder, what was the disconnect with the people who took everything? Didn't they know that it was going to run out?
You know, there was a disconnection from the start when they first got here
on
the American continent.
Yeah, that's something that always puzzles me.
Yeah, yeah. That disconnect came with them.
Yeah.
It came here with them.
How big is the Kashaya Pomo tribe now?
About 600 members. Uh-huh. We almost became extinct.
Uh-huh.
Between 1796 and 1900.
Mm-hmm.
By 1900, out of 1600 people, Kashai people, we had only 109 left.
Only 109 left. Wow.
Yeah. So I'm glad we were.
That gives me chills.
Yeah.
And so you're now about 600.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about the Point Arena, the Manchester Point Arena tribe? How many?
We have approximately 1,200 members in our tribe, and we're located just about 20 miles north of our sister tribe at Kashaya.
Mm-hmm. Now, where is the tribe? Where are you located, the Kashaya?
We're in the northwestern Sonoma County.
Okay.
Yeah, up in the mountains.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you're?
And we are located
in Manchester?
Actually, we're located between Point Arena and Manchester on the Garcia River. So that was our territory, and in fact, our trade and contact with our Kashaya family was through down all the way to the Walala River. Uh-huh. So they controlled all of that territory south of there, and we had the territory north of there. Uh-huh. And you know, it wasn't until the Europeans named us Pomo. Each of our tribes had different names. Our tribe was actually Bokea people. So, you know, they weren't known as the Pomo people. Uh-huh. It was linguistically a Pomoan dialect because of that linguistic closeness. That's how they arrived at calling the name, us Pomo tribes.
So Bokea?
Bokea.
Bokea. And what was the Kashaya?
Our first name was, when we got here, was people from on top of the land. And our old people were good gamers. And so they named us Kashaya. Uh-huh. It's I don't know what you'd call it. What it means is expert gamblers.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So it stuck. Uh-huh. So we call ourselves Kashaya now. Yeah.
Okay. Now, one thing you mentioned a little bit ago, sea anemone. How do you eat sea anemone?
Very carefully. Most of the elders had a lot of food, and it's like younger folks like myself tended to stay away from other things. You know, we were more, I guess, citified, mm-hmm. you know, coming from, I guess, a modern era. Mm-hmm. And there were some things that, you know, we would kind of put our nose up in the air at, which, you know, the older elders found, you know, kind of, I guess, annoying, I guess one could say. But again,
young people rebel.
Fried. Yeah, they were harvested and they were fried and boiled in all sorts of other ways in order.
I was very fond of them as a child. Uh-huh. I wanted to be a marine zoologist, and uh-huh. I wanted to specialize in cilantrates, sea anemones, and corals and that sort of thing. So,
detail a little more of what Nelson was talking about is it's like abalone. You have to pry it off the rocks.
Yeah.
And get some salt water and put the sea anemone into mm-hmm. that. And so they excrete a lot of their, like sand and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then when you get it home, what you do is to slice it like a, biscuit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then take each of those and flour it and then deep fry it.
Okay.
Oh, gosh, it's so good. Yeah.
Do you eat the tentacles?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
It's where those little, it probably make your tongue tingle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Violet, did you grow up in the Kashaya community?
Yes. Yeah, I did.
I want to talk a little bit more about the foods that you currently are denied access to and, you know, really anything, what you remember as a child eating them, but also how are they used in ritual? I mean, as well as, or if they are, maybe they're not, maybe I'm wrong. And anybody?
Well, for me, and I spoke about this the other day, for me, when we look at when I was looking at my life, thinking about the effect that this Marine Life Preservation Act was going to have, I talked about going to the beach with my grandfather or my dad or my uncles, and when I look back on that, it was a time where where those people would teach us. They would teach us not only how to gather, but they would talk about respecting the water. My grandfather would talk about the ocean as if it was a live thing. He mm-hmm. would say, never turn your back on it or it'll get angry, you know. And as a little boy, you know, it made me realize that this is a living thing that needs to be respected and taken care of. And the things that we gather from there, we were taking it not only not only to have something to eat, but it was always important. And one of the things that was always stressed was that it was something that we shared. Mm-hmm. It was a big no-no if you didn't share your food with anybody. You take it back to, you know, to our homes, and we give it out. That's part of what we were told that would continue to give us good luck when we gathered. Mm-hmm. It's a way to teach respect for what we're taking. And it's also a way to remember that we are to that our purpose is to feed each other, not be selfish with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we did these gatherings, we would put up our ceremonial picnics for our seasonal ceremonies. They became a part of that. You know, mm-hmm. that's a part of that. Those ceremonies are thanking the Creator for providing us with these things, mm-hmm. and respecting them and telling them that, telling these things that, you know, we are thankful that you sacrificed yourself so mm-hmm. that we can continue to be alive and healthy.
So what are some of the things other than, I mean, we've talked about seaweed, periwinkle, clams, mussels, abalone, and various seaweeds, and you mentioned... Violet, you mentioned acorns and acorn mush. I think that's the one thing we sort of know about if we just went to standard public school. You learn about acorn mush. But what are some of the other foods that might be on that ceremonial table? Would you have game, for example? Coastal game?
Oh, yeah. Deer meat.
Quail.
Quail.
Huckleberries. Yeah.
Okay, huckleberries.
Salmon, steelhead.
Okay, salmon. I was wondering about salmon.
Salmon, steelhead, and they all play a really significant part for us in our religious ceremonies. And
could you talk a little bit about how the role the salmon plays in those ceremonies? I think that'd be really interesting.
Well, what happens is I know that when I was growing up on the reservation, very small young boy, that as Eric mentioned, that the responsibility for the tribal members were to take care of the elders and the children. So this is where we have kind of a conflict, like with the European concept of their bags and takes. For example, the tribal members who were young were taught at a very young age to fish, whether with traps, baskets, and gill nets and other things in order to, for example, to get salmon. The salmon up along the north coast during the winter runs and spring runs used to be so thick that you could actually get into creeks and you could actually lift them out with your arms. The water would be churning with white foam, and you would actually feel them just, you know, slamming against you while you're standing in the creek, and you mm-hmm. could just sweep them out with your arms up mm-hmm. onto the banks, and then we would take them home, and they would be divided among all of the elders and all of the other folks. So mm-hmm. the fish, you may have gotten maybe 8 or 10 fish, you know, between 4 or 5 guys, young guys.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't for one individual family.
Mm-hmm. It was shared for the whole community.
It was shared for the whole community. Uh-huh. And whatever was left, that is what the fisher person got.
Uh-huh.
So all of the fish was actually uh-huh. given out before they took their uh-huh. share. And that, again, that led to respect and order in our community. And the same thing, you know, with deer, any game birds or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But what's also interesting, it also taught us being resourceful, particularly like with the fish. For example, the salmon, some people would have like the salmon would be called the steak, and some people would like the tail. And my favorite was actually the salmon head, because it actually has a lot of meat inside it.
Oh,
one
yeah.
of the favorite things my aunt used to cook when the kids would come to her house, we were actually raised by their village. My aunt would, as soon as you come in, she'd say, "You're hungry," and she'd bake up fish heads, and she'd make fresh Indian bread, and we'd have these baked salmon heads with acorn mush and Indian bread, and it was always a treat. And again, the same thing mm-hmm. with berries gathering, whether they're salmon berries, blackberries, huckleberries, blueberries, strawberries, whatever, they would make pies and all sorts mm-hmm. of other things.
Now, are there still salmon berries and huckleberries on the coast here?
Yes.
Oh, there are? Okay.
Yes.
I hadn't realized that.
Yeah.
So, raspberries, too. Yeah. Raspberries are good.
Oh, yeah.
And hazelnuts.
Hazelnuts.
Yeah. Hazelnuts.
Now, are they cultivated or are they wild?
Wild.
They're wild.
Really? We have wild hazelnuts here.
Yeah.
I mm-hmm. did not know that. Mm-hmm. I've seen salmon berries, but I saw salmon berries in Alaska. I gathered some salmon berries in Alaska. I was stayed at a fish camp. And,
yeah.
you know, they eat very much a subsistence diet from
right.
what they get.
And again, we also have not only that, we do have plants and things that are very religious to us
mm-hmm.
that
what
we use. For example, we use angelica root, and we use
uh-huh.
other roots and things that, again, just like the sedge roots that were used by our basket makers, you know, they took care to ensure that, you know, the roots were cared for and the plants were cared for.
Mm-hmm.
And there are areas that are very sacred to our people where only the religious people are allowed to go, and the rest of us don't go into those areas. Mm-hmm. You know, and we don't even disturb them.
Yeah.
And again, you know, this is like bringing order, and it's our own way of taking care of our own environment and being a steward for our own environments. Mm-hmm. That, you know, has gone on for thousands of years.
Now, Otis, you're in part a historian.
Yes.
And what I'm wondering for listeners, and I bet that a number of our listeners tonight, this is probably the most in-depth exploration they've heard of coastal tribes. Are there books now? Are there written records that talk about the tribes and some of the traditions or just the history that people want to know more?
Yeah, a colleague and I just published a book called, what was it, Environment of the California Indians.
Okay.
Yeah.
Environment of the California?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that goes through, it depicts different tribes in California.
Mm-hmm.
That was a project. That was a good project.
Uh-huh.
I learned a lot myself in the history. It was something that I wanted to do, and my colleague wanted to do it, so you know that's what we did. It took us 3 years, but you know,
good books take a while.
Yeah.
Well, what I will do is I will post on Mouthful's fan page. I don't even know if they're still called fan pages because now you like something rather than become a fan of it. But on Mouthful's page, I will post the title of this book, and if there's a web link for information for the tribes and for what's going on, I'll post that as well. And in the meantime, is there anything that people can do to support your efforts to get access to what you need access for to continue your way of life? Is there any letters, anything people can do to show support?
I believe, from my perspective, anything that the listeners can do and people who actually want to see our indigenous people in California actually get ahead, you know, is do a letter writing campaign, support it to both the Fish and Game, the Marine Life Preservation Act, and send letters to Ken Wiseman, who's the director, outlining
Ken,
any
what's his
Wiseman.
Name? Ken Wiseman.
Yes. Outlining their support of the tribes in order to enable us to get exemptions within this law to permit us to keep our culture alive.
Okay. Okay, I will post all this information on Mouthful. It's a mouthful to remember, so I will get it all up on Mouthful's Facebook page. And people can always write to me, and I do hear from listeners. You can always send me an email at catsmilk@sonic.net to get this information as well. Well, I want to thank all of you. Eric Wilder, former chairman, right?
Correct.
Yes, and your big sister, my hula sister, Violet Wilder, thank you again for setting this up. This, for me, has been a really interesting hour.
Thank you, Michelle. This is a great opportunity to get, you know, some word out.
You know, and if things change, then you'll have to come back. If you have an event coming up, you'll have to come back another time. Also, Otis Parrish, tribal elder, historian, author, very articulate with your storytelling. Thank you. And then Nelson Pinola. Did I get Pinola?
Yes.
Got that right. Chairman of the Manchester Point Arena POMO. I wish you all the best of luck as you pursue this.
Thank you, Michelle.
And I wish you
thank
an you abundant spring and summer. Meet me back here next week for another yummy episode of Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. Thanks for tuning in. Good night and goodbye.
Just say, say, say.